What's up, everyone? How's it going? We're here to discuss and tease apart Tomer and Matt's awesome movie that they made and released today. I also want to talk about why today and not yesterday, as well as every other aspect of Bitcoin that you talk about in the actual video. But before, just want to talk a little bit about Bitcoin 2022, Ultimate Bitcoin event in Miami, next April 6th through the 9th. I believe I got to see and meet many of the people who are on stage at Bitcoin 2021, and a lot of history is made at that event, and we feel honored to be a place where the Bitcoin community gathers and makes history and continues to make history with Bitcoin, as Tomer illustrates amazingly inside of this beautiful film, too. You can use promo code Satoshi to get 10% off. If you pay with Bitcoin, you get another $100 off. And yeah, I think ticket prices go up tomorrow. Buy your tickets low. Prices are going up. They're programmed that way. And yeah, come meet Brecky. Come meet Tomer. Come meet all these amazing Bitcoiners in person at Bitcoin 2022 in Miami at the Ultimate Bitcoin Cultural Event. All right. That's it for me. Tomer, Matt, what is up?
Hey, everyone.
Hey there.
Let's just jump into Bitcoin is generational wealth. I guess, Tomer, do you want to discuss the story behind the film and sure. We can start from there?
Sure. The other person to keep an eye out for is Louis Liu, who funded the project from Mimesis Capital. So if he shows up and asks to be on stage, please invite him up. And this production really begins with Louis reaching out to me. Louis runs a family office. He recently posted about how his family's history is one of these families that was ruined in 1948 in China when the communists took over. He could tell his story. And he was enjoying my articles. He enjoyed one that I'd written about a work of art that he'd collected. And we got to talking to each other. He's in Taiwan. I'm in Canada. The internet's a wonderful thing, and Bitcoin draws us together. And he asked me if I would write an article on generational wealth. He told me a little bit of his family story. And I was moved by it. And I knew that there was something there, but it was a really hard topic to cover because I didn't have the full idea of what in the movie, for those who've already seen it, I was really struggling with how do you write about Bitcoin being good for multiple generations of families when it hasn't even been around for 12 years at the time or 13 years at the time. And so I struggled with it. And it wasn't until we got to talking and I realized, you know what, my wife's family was also ruined in the mid-1940s by World War II. And it turns out I know a lot of families that had to rebuild from scratch. And that was the seed of the idea for the article. And I said, well, if I can go back in time, maybe I can project forward in time. And I talked to a lot of Bitcoiners who are filled with hope and who just aren't filled with hope, like empty hope, who are working hard to build the future. I was speaking with a Canadian here who works for the commission that's studying these small-scale nuclear reactors and is taking the bids from one. And he was teaching me about that. And I talked to Untapped Growth, and he's doing the regenerative agriculture for Bitcoiners. And I talked to Fractal Encrypt, who's making all this beautiful art. And I talked to lots of people who are homeschooling and educating. I did a whole podcast on the separation of state and education. And I could just see all of these things coming together. So I put them all into this one essay that I wrote for him. And then just before I shared it with him, I was having a therapy session and I read it to my therapist or my coach. And as I was reading to him, I said, wow, this would make such a better movie than an article. So I presented it to Louis and I said, do you think we could make a movie out of it? And he enthusiastically supported it. So the next morning, I reached out to my new friend, Matt, who I met at a Toronto Bitcoin meetup. And told him about this. And we started working on this project together. I don't know, Matt, if you want to jump in, this is where you enter the picture.
Yeah, it was a great intro, Tomer. The way I got involved was I'd been going down quite far into the Bitcoin rabbit hole. And I literally told my creative partners, because I run like a little production company and animate studio. And I told my creative partners, I was like, guys, I have to do something in Bitcoin. I don't know what it is, but I just have a desire to contribute to this thing in some way. And I don't know how, but so I had that in my head. And then I shortly after saw that there was a Bitcoin meetup happening in Toronto that Brandon Quidham retweeted. And it was at this amazing, cool tea house called Bampot Tea in Toronto. And they were having this meetup So I thought, okay, I'll go to this meetup and see what happens. And I immediately connected with all the Bitcoiners there and met Tomer. And I had read some of Tomer's writing already, so I knew a little bit about his approach to everything and liked his takes and perspectives, and we connected. And then he brought it up, or actually I made a little Bitcoin meme talking about how much I love Bitcoin, and I showed it to Tomer and he liked it, and maybe that percolated into said that I could do some sort of video. I suppose he had this opportunity to make this into a video, and he came to me and said, hey, do you want to try to tackle that? So that's how it got started. And then the first draft of the script was about a 30-minute read. And I was like, okay, maybe we can pull this down a little bit and make it more suited to the screen. So we hacked away at it for a couple of days and brought it down to something we thought would be maybe closer to 10 to 15 minutes. And from there, we just got started on the production with everything. So yeah, that's the origin story of how we got connected and my involvement.
To me, this is a story of Bitcoiners finding Bitcoiners. Right? Like, Lewis found me, I found Matt, and we found each other through Bitcoin meetups. And I guess that's the interesting thing. There's so much talent and desire to be creative in this space that everything seems serendipitous in this whole thing. But we're also eager to work and contribute to Bitcoin, that it turns out not to be that hard to find people. And I've always said this about Bitcoiners, and I continue to experience it with all the Bitcoiners I work with. Everyone's so committed that they give their very best and they do their very best job. So for me, I'd seen some of Matt's work. Matt is a part of this group called Shy Kids, and they have this wonderful video that the people who ran this tea shop loved, and it's called I Love Everything. And I think I love everything too. So Matt and I connected. He'd actually written us, done this wonderful 3-minute music video. And I don't know if you want to tweet it, Matt, a link to it, and then you can share it in the nest when you get a chance when we're talking about something else. It's like a 3-minute, just delightful, benevolent, fun tune that you won't be able to get out of your head. And it's fun to watch the video because it was the video that made me think, oh, you know what? It's a lot of different shots, documentary style in a sense. That thing's very light and our thing is heavy. But I had a sense Matt could absolutely do this and ran it by him. And from there on, like when he and I got together to start working, as he said, when we edited the original article down by about 35 to 50%. We just did it in one afternoon together in his condominium, and we recorded a rough draft right there. And then we got together the next week in the studio when he'd already selected a lot of the music, and I recorded the narration, which is a fun story, which we'll talk about at some point during the session, because I know a lot of people have written to me about how much they liked the quality of the narration. So there's a story behind that too.
I wanted to ask Matt, the creative process for this, can you maybe talk a little bit about how you put this film together? Because you use, I think, mostly stock footage here, and the way you did it is it's really seamless, sort of the flow from very old stock footage to this new, very hopeful stock footage. And I just want to compliment you on the editing. That was the first thing I told Tomer when he showed me an early cut, that I was blown away by the editing. How did you approach the script and then go and find all the footage? Was the script just the narration, or had Tomer, did you give notes on, oh, I think a shot of X, Y, and Z might be good here? Or how did it go from script to actual film?
It was a bit of a messy process. These things, you start off with a really wide casted net of footage and then hone it in over time when you find the right shots. So what we did was we had the Google Doc. We had a doc of the script. And as we were cutting it down, we made comments beside each line like, oh, maybe this shot could have some footage of rockets taking off, or this shot could have footage of families doing some farm work, and this shot could be old footage of people struggling in the horrible conditions of after the war. So we had rough ideas of themes for each kind of line and each era. We had this idea of different themes and a rough idea of the shots. And then basically my team and I, we spend probably a week just scouring the internet. There's a website called internetarchive.org where we found, like, and it's all public domain free footage. And we just scoured that for all of the old footage and probably had about 150 clips. And slowly selected down the ones we thought fit best with all the with the narration. And then as we like went through the years, we just ripped again like hundreds of YouTube clips from newscasts of the 2008 crisis and all the stuff happening there. And particularly in 2008, there's footage of Usain Bolt and the Olympics. And we wanted to not only just have footage that like touched on the themes, but also just the mood of 2008. Thinking back, it felt like a hopeful time of like triumph of humanity or whatever. So we wanted to paint a little picture of that and touch on like the moods of the era. And yeah, 1948 was stock footage of really old stuff. And then 2021 was all YouTube clips. And then as we like went into the future, 2048, 2109, that's all just really good stock footage that we were able to find online. And again, that was just a process of casting a wide net of possible shots we could use and then slowly whittling down to our favorite ones.
I would add, this went through a bunch of iterations. Like Matt did a first cut of it that I would say is probably like 60 to 70% of what ended up largely in there. And he showed it to us. We actually watched it. The first time I saw it was at another one of these Toronto meetups at the same place where it was late in the evening by the time he got the cut from his audio team. So there were maybe only 10 of us there, but we watched the first cut of this video and all the music was already there and it was pretty awesome. But I wanted to make it more awesome because there was a scene with the agriculture and I'd been talking to Untapped Growth and we had stock footage of cows and some of them were fat, some of them were in pen. And I reached out to Joel, who's to Untapped Growth, and he sent us all those beautiful pictures of the cows that you see roaming the fields, which are actually regeneratively raised organ cows. And there were lots of these other shots where we started reaching out to other people and we brainstormed some of the areas that were clumsy. And so I think the thing went through three major revisions before it got to this final, most polished state or that it's released to the state.
Yeah. And then we also, like all the titles, like the year is 2048, those are all things we animated ourselves. And then the graphic scene where it's like showing the 2009 Chancellor on the brink of bailouts scene, like we created those graphics. But yeah, it's like probably 90% stock footage and stuff like that. And then the last 10% is stuff we animated in-house.
Part of how we edited the script, Matt had a vision for the Bitcoin black hole destroying all the evil in the world early on. And so when we were editing the script, he was like, make sure to leave lots of stuff for the black hole to destroy. Like, gone are the monocrop cultures, gone is this, gone is that. So that's why the script contains so many of these gone. I'll actually be publishing the original article, the longer one that Matt mentioned. It'll be first privately available because I write for Swan Bitcoin, a private newsletter, private clients, and I'm going to be publishing it in there in early November, or like November 12th. And then within a few weeks, we'll release it on the blog to everybody else. But we want to make a really nice production of the original article itself, too. And then once it's nicely produced, we'll be able to share it out with everybody else. I think it'll be lucky if we get a couple of thousand reads of that. We've already got 11 or 12,000 views of the video because videos are just so nice. But for people who want to go deeper and see what the original concept was, it'll be there for them pretty soon. We'll focus on the movie for now.
Tomer, you chose to release this movie today, and today is the day after the day which most people think is White Paper Day. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I'll be totally 100% honest. I thought October 31st was Bitcoin White Paper Day, and I wanted to release it on October 31st. And I met with the team at Swan to talk about this just a few days ago. And there was confusion because many of them have this, the Book of Satoshi, and it says that the white paper was released at 7:15, or like at this time, the exact moment that we started this meetup on November 1st. And so there was confusion, but they held the book up and I didn't trust them because I'm a Bitcoiner and I say, don't trust, verify, but they showed me the book. And they also said it was much better to release a movie the day after Halloween than on Halloween when everybody's at a party, which kind of won the argument in any event. And so there was all this confusion. It felt like one of these Mandela effects, the Berenstain Bears. Everyone's convinced, like, what's going on here? It turns out that Satoshi did send the Bitcoin white paper to the Cypherpunk mailing list on October 31st. So I think that's the official date. But that the remailer did not send out the digest until 4:15 Pacific time November 1st. So that's where the confusion was. And there may be some other of my colleagues on here who can clarify that a little bit.
We're both right.
All the best. And what this made me realize is before the launch of Bitcoin, we didn't know what the fuck happened. We just didn't have a reliable time chain.
Now, time was meaningless.
Now we know. And if we said it was released at a particular block or in a particular transaction, there it is. It's in that block. It's not, it was sent at this time and received that time. Look, there's the confirmed time and that's that. And so it reminds me of Gigi's article, Bitcoin is Time. He points out in there that in the digital realm, we never really had any sense of time or certainty of what came before and what came after. But we do now, thanks to Bitcoin. And we don't have to deal with this terrible crisis ever. But I think I have to apologize for the promise of releasing it on the 13th birthday of Bitcoin's white paper, because I was, in the end of the day, I was mistaken that I was correct and then mistaken and now I'm recorrected that it was yesterday.
But what the heck?
We all had to wait an extra day.
That's a great story and some nice history there. So y'all were referring to the movie without really teasing it out for those who may not have already watched the film. I think it makes sense to actually go step by step through the progression that you tell in the story, Tomer.
I chose to start the story in 1948. The year is 1948. And I could have started plus or minus 1 or 2 years from there. But I wanted to start with the last time we had this terrible collapse in our civilization, which was World War II. And World War II was a world war. We Westerners, who I think are most of the audience here, tend to think of it as something that took place predominantly in Europe, but it took place in Asia as well. And it had devastating effects all over the world. Millions, tens of millions of people died in horrible ways. And it was really, when you look at it in a historical lens, it was just a continuation of World War I, which was equally horrible. And so much was destroyed, like buildings bombed, cities firebombed, atomic bombs dropped on. It was a terrible time of devastation. And we can't imagine the horror. Those of us who had grandparents or great-grandparents who were around and lived there and told us the tales, they were shocking. My wife's grandparents were interned in concentration camps. They were lucky to survive. The stories that they tell are, like, when I say they were lucky to survive, they were like 100 times where the odds were 99% that they would die. Like, they're at the extreme end of lucky for what happened and living by their smarts. And they left Europe with nothing. In her case, they came to Canada in the belly of a boat. Her mother was born just before and carried as a baby in the compartment of a boat. And they had to build everything from scratch. And Lewis tells a similar story of what happened in Asia. So I wanted to concretize, yes, civilization falls, and it fell not too long ago, and we had to rebuild, and the danger of it comes, and everyone talks amongst Bitcoiners about Weimar Germany and how the inflation led to the collapse of the civilization and created the openings for the tyrants to step in. And the money has a lot to do with this, right? Wars were fought over gold, and wars were fought over money, and wars ended when the money ran out and you couldn't pay the soldiers anymore. But it was always war over money. And so I wanted to stress that, and I wanted to show both the devastation and the spirit of rebuilding, because part of what I'm headed for in this movie is we get to rebuild, but what if we don't keep getting torn down? What if we actually manage to rebuild and maintain the rebuilding and not see collapse and fall and devastation? And that in the short little article that I wrote for Bitcoin Magazine, it was like, what happens if we have an unfallible civilization built on the shoulders of an infallible money? So that's why I started in 1948. I wanted to really remind people or demonstrate to them, if they hadn't seen it, this is in our recent history. The people who lived it are now all dying. They're all passing away, but it shouldn't be forgotten.
Lewis, I think this is a good spot for you to jump in, just because we haven't really gone into the detail into the future that Tomer kind of sees and illustrates in the film and the article. Do you want to chime in with maybe your personal story around your family needing to rebuild and the opportunity you see with Bitcoin?
My story is simple. Tomer mentioned in 1949, I think there's a lot of turmoil and chaos happening around the world, especially in the Asia and Europe when World War II started. And my family suffered aftermath when there's like two parties fighting a civil war in China. We all know it's a nationalist versus a communist. And nationalists actually defeated, so they escaped, retreat back to Taiwan. And Taiwan during the time was guarded by Japan, by the Japanese. And they got defeated in World War II. So they left Taiwan with defeated. And then nationalists come to Taiwan and basically confiscate every resident's wealth. And we have this kind of law being implemented where all your land is going to belong to the nationalist party. So the wealth being redistributed centered on the high guard of the nationalist party. So that was the background. And my family kind of suffered around the historical moment. All the lands being confiscated. We pretty much lost all the wealth, start from zero. And we spent a couple generations to rebuild that wealth back. And that kind of reminds me kind of a historical background. We really shouldn't be feel safe because there's a lot of historical evidence that it might happen again. I'm not saying be pessimistic about it, but at least we need to defend ourselves against the situation. And it looks like, you know, in modern time, after COVID, there's a lot of tension between Taiwan and China. I'm starting to see this kind of conflict happen again. If that happens as a Taiwanese or as someone in that kind of situation, you need to find a way, a tool, technology to escape or isolate yourself from that situation. And Bitcoin like gives that opportunity and solution to that problem. And which that inspired me is to contact Tomer and later Matthew to construct this film and bring this concept to the light.
Yeah, I think one of the other things that really inspired me about this story is Lewis is a young guy and he's attuned to this and he doesn't want to see this happen again to his family. And he has recognized Bitcoin and invested substantially in Bitcoin. Like he's not a LARPer. He's the real deal. He's taken his family off his family wealth, and secured it with Bitcoin. And that's very real because many people would say that's a huge gamble. You should diversify into real estate and companies and this and that, the other. And I don't know exactly what his portfolio is, but I know he has a lot of Bitcoin or he's heavily about investing in Bitcoin. And it's that kind of commitment that I think is what paves the way for me to start thinking about. But there really are families that are serious about Bitcoin. And they're serious about it in preserving it. And that kind of leads me to the next thing. So I don't know if you wanted to add anything about your conviction and your time frame around Bitcoin and how you told me your story, Lewis, but maybe you can if you want, and then we can move forward into the story.
Sure. So it got me really start thinking when there's a geopolitical conflict between US and China, and that leads to conflicts between Taiwan's nationalism and obviously Communist Party. Agenda. And if that happens, there's an urgent sense of where to park your wealth. I think not a lot of people actually thinking about it, but they think this is just something that might just go away. And I don't think so. I think there's a real threat in this certain senses. So you need to be prepared for that. In around past 2 to 3 years, I convinced my family to park most of the cash, not all of the cash, into Bitcoin. And we saw this COVID crisis coming. And there's no way to do actual business during the COVID time. So what you're going to do with your excess cash or how do you store your wealth? That become a real problem. And also the existential threat coming from, you know, Communist Party. So the only way to store your wealth or to protect hard-earned money from your family, business, or whatever is to try to find this type of hedge that's available to everyone. If I'm American, I won't be able to access to Taiwanese stock. If I'm Taiwanese, I might be not able to access to American stocks. But Bitcoin's type of asset that pretty much everyone around the world can access to it. And it's globally tradable. It's better store value than gold. So that's make us to think this is probably the only solution to navigate this problem.
Yeah, thanks, Lewis.
Yo, what is going on, plebs? We're going to take a break from our programming to tell you about the resurrection of our print magazine, starting with the El Salvador issue. Starting this fall, Bitcoin Magazine will be available on newsstands nationwide and at retail stores such as Barnes and Noble. Don't want to get off your couch though? No problem. You can also go to store.bitcoinmagazine.com. So skip the line and get each issue shipped directly to your front door with our annual subscription. I'm talking 4 issues a year that contain exclusive interviews and profiles with leading Bitcoiners, actionable insights on the state of the market, breaking news and cultural trends, along with powerful photos and artwork from the best artists in the world. Subscribe today and get 21% off using code podcast at checkout. That's PODCAST, podcast at checkout.
So here we have a big problem that keeps happening in the world, which is our nations keep falling, their currencies keep failing, and it's real and it's serious. And it's the same devastating story over and over again. So that's where this begins. And if you want me to keep going on, the next chapter is unavoidable, right? 2008, that's the moment in history where Bitcoin shows up on the scene. That's what we're celebrating yesterday, some of us mistakenly today. And I really wanted to be able to share the contrast of all of these things that were going on. It was a time of extravagance. It was suddenly also a time of surprise ruin. I know suddenly there's a financial crisis. And I was there during the financial crisis. I didn't hear about Bitcoin. I didn't hear about Bitcoin until 2013, and I'm an early adopter. And so I really wanted to highlight, like, Satoshi's my hero. And I wanted to highlight what it was that Satoshi did as well in this. So I wanted to tell the story of 2008. We're having a great time, but suddenly everything, we get a rug pull, and the people in power use it to take advantage, right? The banks that failed didn't fail. They were too big to fail. They got the bailouts. And none of them paid any price. Nobody went to jail. Nobody personally was fined. Even if you were fined, it didn't affect your career. And so it really demonstrated that the true two-class system that we have, where those of us who work and suffer the consequences of our failures, and those of us who don't really work and don't suffer the consequences of our failure. And it bothered Satoshi too, obviously, because when he launches Bitcoin, first of all, he's got the motivation to create it, right? And the genius and the brilliance that those of us who study it are just blown away by, how someone created an invention so effective and so principled, so disciplined, and made himself part of this invention too, right? Like his anonymity, his pseudonymity is part of what Bitcoin is, along with his disappearance, which comes later in the video. And it's incredible, but he toils alone in darkness, in pseudonymity. And I really wanted to portray that in the article that I wrote. And we ended up having a really nice demonstration of it, I think, in the video, which this is one of the things that we went back a second time around. I can't remember even what was exactly in the first cut of the video, in that part where we say, meanwhile, in the dark, deserted recesses of the information high network that now spans the globe, lone engineer toils.
It was just a white paper.
It was pictures of the white paper, but I said the white paper didn't quite even exist yet. He was writing code. He was toiling, writing away code. So I found the pre-release version of the code. It's still on SourceForge or somewhere. Or it was on BitcoinTalkForum.org. There were all these old copies of all the source data. And so we put it in there, and Matt just edited it so beautifully of, like, here's the code of how a transaction goes in and how a transaction goes out, and it goes out to a public key and this and that. And then just speeding up the scrolling of it to demonstrate the volume of work that Satoshi did. And that's how the 2008 portion of the video ends. And I find it quite moving myself, because it ends without those words. You know, he's trying to create something that may serve as money, that will never be corrupted by tyrants, liars, fools, or thieves, whatever the exact order of the description there was. And that's what Satoshi did. And we're all really grateful for it today, those of us who appreciate
the invention. Satoshi created hope for millions of families in 2008, which a lot of families lost hope, wealth got destroyed. There's really no solution to that problem. What we've done is money printing. So Bitcoin really offers that hope, or you can say the solution to the money printing problem, which caused a lot of chaos. Even nowadays, governments, politicians still using the same method to solve the problem, which the problem itself is the money printing. So I think that clips in the film really showcase the transition that in the modern era, when stuff become very bad, that's in 2008 and forward to now, 2020, the COVID crisis, which the problem become bigger.
Yeah. So if we're going through it, this takes us to the third part of the video, which is the year is 2021. It's now. And the whole thing is just to say the world is in turmoil once again. Everything that we were, like 2008 was just a practice run. It's feeling a lot more like the kind of things that led up to 1948. We have a world in turmoil again, and it's a yucky world. Without Bitcoin, it's a world without hope. I don't know where else anyone looks for hope. And I'm happy to be corrected. Someone raise your hand and tell me what sign of hope exists besides Bitcoin. We're the only optimistic subculture that I'm aware of. Everybody else is feeling the nihilism and the despair creeping up. Mark Zuckerberg offers us a vision of the future where there's no smell, there's no taste, there's no touch, there's just low-res video and audio with something strapped to your face in his metaverse. And the World Economic Foundation offers us a future where we're eating bugs and owning nothing and living in pods. It's not a pretty picture. But Bitcoin is offering something different. And that's really all I wanted to stress in the 2021 portion of the video. It's we need to talk about the here and now, because it's being made for people in the here and now. And the here and now, aside from Bitcoin, doesn't look optimistic. But then I didn't want to talk about what might happen in the next few years. I think this was one of the things that I thought was somewhat clever about the formulation of the piece. It's not trying to talk about the details of what we do in August of 2022 or in September of 2023. It says we have a lot of work ahead of ourselves, but let's take a look at what the final product of that work is. And so let's leap forward to 100 years from when the video started, or when the story started, to 2048. And let's look at all the things that Bitcoiners are actually working towards. And when our money takes over, we get to work on the things we want to work on. And because our money is money for generations, it's indestructible, it's unstoppable, it's unseizable, it's incorruptible. We'll be able to work for generations, and our work won't be stopped. We won't have fools who are also tyrants steal our money, steal our capital, destroy our businesses. We'll actually be able to keep them running for generations. And what are we working towards? It's amazing how Bitcoin changes you. It changes you to want to work for the good that'll go beyond your lifespan. And for those of you who are in the crowd who are new Bitcoiners, you may think I'm crazy. And for those of you who are longtime Bitcoiners, you're all nodding in agreement. So it just takes time for you to see it. But I was able to just looking at the inspiration of the people who are doing things already in Bitcoin and seeing where the technology was headed and knowing what I myself would want to work on and support and seeing how many Bitcoiners are trying to build these citadels that have all of these things in common, access to clean energy. We talk about stranded energy, clean energy building, right? Like just everywhere that Bitcoin touches, clean energy comes up. The talk of regenerative agriculture comes up. The talk of better education, right? Like again, we went through the Industrial Revolution and we industrialized everything into mass-produced facilities, including humans. Like the whole education system is putting people into a assembly line. You go through kindergarten, then you go through grade one, then you go through grade two, and everybody goes through the exact same process. You learn the exact same thing at the exact same time everywhere in your country, in the world, because that's what your nation mandates as the learning experience. It's an industrial approach to raising human beings. And I personally don't believe we're widgets to be raised industrially so that we come out the other end of the machine all shaped to the way that a country wants, but not in the shape that we were meant to grow in. And these are all the things that I saw for Bitcoin. And I wanted to say, let's leap over the challenges and turmoil that we have. This is meant to be the inspiring video. Let's show the outcome as a work of to inspire people. And that's what the 2048 chapter of this thing is. It talks about all these industries. And I had even more industries I wanted to talk about, but there was a time limit. I wanted to talk about medicine and healthcare and mental health, which I think are also all going to be things that become so much better than they are today. But time is limited, so I focused on the ones that we had and painted this beautiful vision of life, of agriculture, of education, of being, of choosing your profession and doing what it is that you want to do, of clean energy generation, and of housing just being available, because that's another one of these areas that I just think is so tragic today. The only reason a house costs $1 million instead of $200,000 is because there's two bidders for it, and a bank is standing behind each one saying, here, take another $800,000 of debt, right? If the banks weren't there offering all this free debt, then people would only be paying $200,000 or like whatever the right number is, right? They'd be paying a lot less. But we're all leveraging our houses up with 5x debt to 1x equity or whatever the number is, or 4x debt to 1x equity. And that's all because of the money printing. That's the only reason. And so we all become enslaved in paying our mortgages for forever. And they do the same thing with education, with, you know, college education, where it used to cost $10,000, $14,000 when I was in university. Now it costs $200,000 for no good reason other than that they'll lend you that much money. So that much money pours into the system. So I really want to envision a time when there's nobody who will lend you that kind of money because nobody's going to part with their Bitcoin. And so that was the 2048 piece of it. And the 2048 piece now blends in with the final piece, which is the 2109, which is now 100 years after the launch of Bitcoin. And that one for me was just putting the cap on the story to say 100 years after Bitcoin's launched, it hasn't fallen, it hasn't failed. And when you have sound money being sound for 100 years, what can you imagine? The families that actually are responsible and take care of their wealth and take care of the people who help them earn their wealth are dynasties. I just couldn't think of any other word. And Matt found all these beautiful imagery to go along with it. And there's peace in the world because there's nothing to fight wars over when there's productivity and agreement, right? We don't have different currencies. We don't have trade wars. If you think of all the things that we call wars, even though we have real wars with real bombs and real guns and real casualties, but we have the war on drugs, the war on poverty, the trade wars. It's just this endless framing of everything as war. And to me, Bitcoin really changes it. For those of you who read my writing, I've recently published a piece called Bitcoin is a Declaration of Peace. And it just says with Bitcoin, I don't need to be at war with anybody. I can either do business with them or leave them in peace. We don't mean any harm to each other. So maybe at some other point, I'll have an opportunity to share that with this audience. And so that's what I really wanted to end and just leave it with this vision of this beautiful planet that we all live on, living in harmony with it, living in harmony with each other, and knowing that we can rest assured that evil forces of monetary debasement have no power here anymore on this planet because we have Bitcoin.
I love that. And I think that there's a lot of like topics that Bitcoiners are interested in that you touched on in the film that maybe we can dive into. But I'm curious to hear from Corey and Steph. Corey, I know that you've always been a big supporter of Tomer, but big in supporting this film and pushing this out. Where does this kind of resonate with your vision for Bitcoin and why you back this movement in general, you know, with your time and your energy and your company?
Oh man, lots to bite off there. First of all, just congratulations, you guys, especially to Tomer and to Lewis, anybody else that was involved in this. It's absolutely beautiful. My DMs are blowing up. All our Telegram groups are blowing up. This one is having a serious impact. A lot of us have turned our attention toward the future and where Bitcoin can go. And obviously, the longer you've been in the space and the more comfortable you are talking about what Bitcoin is and being capable of getting people you care about at least somewhat invested in it or whatever, your mind starts to turn toward the future. And I think people like Tomer and Gigi and John Vallis and so many more, obviously, going way, way back, just a few sort of top of mind for me, are thinking about what the world is going to be like 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 50 years from now. And I love that these futurists with a Bitcoin affinity are charting a path through their imagination and through their vision and having some fun with it and thinking about it. And I think some of these guys that have the time and put in the time are living in the future. And so then it gets to be this situation where we're like, okay, the future is actually here. It's just not evenly distributed. But we do have friends of ours already living in that bright orange future that I like to talk about. And I aspire to have a little bit more time, maybe after Swan or after Swan hits a steady state and I can bump up to chairman or something like that. But for now, I'm just so heads down. So when I get to just take a breather, watch 35 minutes of This Machine Greens or 15 minutes of the Generational Wealth piece or some of the other beautiful stuff that's coming out now, there's just more and more of it all the time. It just it pulls me out of the weeds and makes me appreciate the movement that we're part of.
Yeah, sure. I think it was really great. Tomer did a great job with, I think, writing it well and all the imagery and the visuals really came together. I think it's interesting because we talk about this idea of Bitcoin. Obviously, we're all bullish on Bitcoin. We think it's going to literally millions of dollars per coin, but it's not really about that. It's more like the social change, the cultural change, I know it's one of those things where obviously people get this feeling of, oh, I'm here for the money. I'm going to buy this coin. I'm going to get rich. But it's honestly and truly, it's not. It's actually about making the world a better place. And that truly is, I think, conveyed in the piece as well, in the video, because you really get that sense of, oh, no, it's actually about what are the relationships we're going to have with our family and our community and the way we're going to treat each other and treat other people, as opposed to nowadays where it's fiat and Keynesianism have turned this world into a dog-eat-dog sort of world when it doesn't have to be that way. And right now, it's like the quote-unquote leaders, many of whom are very corrupt, whether they're like some corrupt bureaucrat or politician, oftentimes it's that the worst rise to the top. And so we're just living in a world where the system is set up in such a bad way that for the most part, obviously there's certain exceptions out there, but for the most part, it's the worst rise to the top in the current Keynesian paradigm. And a lot of the economic paradigms that we've been under are acting as apologists for that. So instead, we're trying to challenge that and say, no, we're switching that out and we're replacing that with our own vision. What do we think it's going to look like? And along with being a Bitcoiner, it's almost like there are certain other things. And look, I get not everyone agrees on every aspect of it, but the Bitcoin, like the Bitcoin carnivore thing and eating lots of meat and being into regenerative agriculture and being into, let's say, homeschooling or other more alternative ideas that are out there. Maybe not all of those things are going to come true or be the way, even though I may, you know, personally have a belief or a view on those things. But the video kind of sketches out a few ideas, and obviously some of the imagery and stuff is there showing that, but it's there to sketch out a vision. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to all go exactly that way, but yeah, great job.
And I just had a question for Tomer and for Stefan also. Tomer, you talk about citadels sometimes, and Stefan, you sign off your podcast with See You in the Citadels. But I think for a lot of people, or maybe a lot of people outside of Bitcoin, there's this kind of misperception of what that actually means. And it's this selfish thing that, oh, we're going to, you know, lock ourselves away from the people without Bitcoin. And I don't think that's what it means at all. And Tomer, I'd love to hear, what does a Bitcoin citadel actually mean to you in the context of this film?
Listen, that's a great question. I think that there's going to be a lot of diversity to these regions. And it's cute that we call them citadels. It's like a big word for city as well. And I really view them as like natural human places. In the state of nature, human beings are like hunter-gatherers, and we live at peace with nature. We don't live very long. We don't have very much technology to aid us. But we rest, like we're not working for anybody else. We gather our food and then we rest. They recently found like some artwork of someone carved a duck out of wood like 30,000 years ago. It's some very ancient piece of art, because this is hunter-gatherers actually had time probably to start creating early art. And then we develop agriculture, which means we develop jobs and we develop property. And when we develop jobs, there are some people who say, well, if I can get someone else to do the work, maybe I can not do the work. I can be in charge of him. And the idea of management comes in, and the idea of slavery eventually comes in, and the idea of someone getting the benefit of somebody else's work creeps in at the same time that the idea of trade is developed. So there's these two sides to specialization, but there's the positive side of we can each specialize and create something, but there's also the dark side of it where people take advantage of it. And we also develop technology, and technology is a double-edged sword. Like we're all terribly addicted nowadays to digital technology, and we don't play on the road and in the grass as much as we used to. And so to me, these Bitcoin citadels, it's this amazing thing about this technology of Bitcoin is it is very organic. It doesn't say you need to stare at the screen, although many Bitcoiners stare at the screen a lot, but it doesn't say you need to stare at the screen and manage this. Like, it's money that you don't have to manage, right? If right now we all are staring at other screens of what's the price of this stock, or what's the price of this, or what's my house worth? With Bitcoin, it's steady. Your wealth is preserved. You earn your wealth by doing work that you think is valuable, that other people agree is valuable. And you choose to stop working when you've earned enough. And so it lets you actually judge what is enough and what isn't. And so I see these citadels as very natural places. And exactly as Matt depicted them in the video, like people not plugged in, maybe using some digital technology here and there, but enjoying nature, enjoying life. I think I'm grateful to Mark Zuckerberg for providing the perfect contrast to what I envision as a citadel, which is his Meta, which is this, you live in a low-res, boring cartoon with nothing satisfying going on. You're clean, I guess, but you don't get your hands dirty. You don't build anything. So to me, these are very peaceful places. They're not like the Citadel sound, like they're armed places, but we live in peace. And I'm 51, and I remember being a kid in the 1970s was a pretty peaceful experience. Sure, there was a bully here and there, and sure, you broke your arm because you did something stupid riding a bicycle down a hill with no hands. So it's not utopian, but it's real, and it's real human, and you fall in love with somebody, and sometimes you fall out of love, and you get your heart broken, and you learn from that, and that's a human experience. It's not sitting on a couch surfing the internet, never really interacting with another human being. So that's what I really can't wait for. And it's also where you're not so obsessed with money that you'll sell your soul, right, that you'll do evil to earn a buck, that the only thing that matters is making a buck. Like I watched our civilization turn, get twisted from you earned money so that you could buy the things you wanted to there's no limit on the amount of money that you chase. And your worth is measured in the amount of money that you possess, which is completely preposterous. Your worth is your soul. Your worth is your personality, your friends, your value to other people and their value to you. That's what's worth. And people just get obsessed with brand names and fancy cars and all these things that really don't provide any happiness. The only joy they provide, which is a very sick form of joy, is they create jealousy in the people who don't have them, who desire them. And when they get them, like the only thing that they're chasing is causing jealousy in somebody else. That's not a healthy way. And it explains to me so much of the mental illnesses that exist in our civilization. And we can just let go and be ourselves and not worry that we can't be ourselves and we have to chase money, because you're either on team makes all the money in the world or team gets all the money in the world stolen from it. Those teams are gone under the Bitcoin standard. Everyone's on the same team. I earn what I earn and I choose what to do with it.
Yeah, sure, man. The thing with Citadels is, so actually for anyone who's not clear, it started from like basically a meme post on Reddit. I think it was 2013 or 14. Basically, it was a time traveler who was coming back from the future to warn everyone to not do this whole Bitcoin thing, guys, because otherwise it's going to end up really bad. And they were saying that all the rich people would have to live in these Citadels. And I think they even call out the Winklevoss twins back then and saying, oh, they were under threat of assassination and things like it was a very dark vision. That was the initial post. But I think the Citadel meme has become more like it's just Bitcoin. It's a bit more like a Rorschach test. You see what you want to see in it. And so if you're coming from a certain point of view, whether that's anti-central banking or the cypherpunk view, then you see in Bitcoin what you want. And so it's a bit like that. And I think Citadels are kind of like that. And people have their own idea of what is a Citadel. Some people think of it's going to be like this Ready Player One VR metaverse thing. And other people think of it more, oh, it's just your home and you just defend it and that's your Citadel. And other people think of it more like the going Galt or Galt's Gulch, or this idea of all the productive people moving away to separate themselves from the collectivists. Like that's another conception of it. But I think, yeah, I guess if I had to spell out what I think it'll be, I think maybe it'll start with maybe a little bit of this whole idea of rich people trying to get away and protect themselves. But I think genuinely, I think it will expand out and it will become more like this kind of open and expansive, prosperous world that we're going to live in. And you just go and live in different zones or different areas based on what you want, what you believe, what you think is cool. And the perception as well of less of the boring and monotonous tasks, it'll be more like the things that you enjoy doing and things that relate to human connection. So I think that's a few ideas around what it might go towards as opposed to drone work, if you will.
Yeah, so it's funny. I think you're creating a temporary Citadel anytime you're around a bunch of Bitcoiners. So like you meet up at a meetup and that feels like the Citadel. I feel like it's the same thing as saying, see you at the finish line or see you at the after party or something like that. You create this little community where you have a ton of trust. I always think when I get together with a group of 5 or 10 Bitcoiners or something like that, you have so much common ground. It's if they pronounce Stefan Lavera correctly and can name one or two of their favorite episodes of Tales from the Crypt or something like that, and can tell you their favorite chapter from the Bitcoin standard, then you can assume a lot about that person. And you don't really need to talk about Bitcoin all that much. You can test a few ideas for 10 or 15 minutes and the other 6 hours that are going to fly by is just going to be about life and plans and fun and all kinds of other things. So I don't think it's like this end destination. I think life is a journey. You got to enjoy it along the way. and folks that are realizing the concentration of Bitcoiners in places like Austin and occasionally around conferences in Miami, or more and more people moving to Nashville or at least stopping by. And us poor folks stuck here in Southern California, making sure that we get together for barbecues at Andy's house once a month, or down with the Orange County people. Like, that is the Citadel. It's a rolling party of Bitcoiners where you feel super comfortable being yourself and knowing that you're around other people that are on, you know, their version of basically the same journey, and you share tons in common with them, and you can trust that they are generally of high integrity and becoming higher integrity all the time, because that's what Bitcoin does to you.
My fellow plebs, the Bitcoin conference is back. Bitcoin 2022, April 6th through the 9th, is the ultimate pilgrimage for the Bitcoin ecosystem. The Bitcoin conference is the biggest event in all of Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. We're leveling up and making this bigger and better than ever. I'm talking straight to the moon with the 4-day long festival in the heart of Miami at the Miami Beach Convention Center. This has something for everyone. Whether you're a high-powered Bitcoin entrepreneur, a core developer, or a Bitcoin newbie, Bitcoin 2022 is the ultimate place for you to be with your people and celebrate and learn about the Bitcoin culture. So make sure to go to bit.tc/conference to lock in your official tickets and use promo code Satoshi for 10% off. Want more off? Pay in Bitcoin and you'll receive $100 off general admission and $1,000 off whale pass. Those are stackable. So go to b.tc/conference and attend the best conference in Bitcoin history. Yo, my fellow Bitcoin lovers, have I got something specifically curated for you? The Deep Dive is Bitcoin Magazine's premium markets intelligence newsletter. This isn't some paid group shilling buy and sell signals. No, this is a premium Bitcoin analysis led by Dylan LeClaire and his team of analysts. They break down in an easily digestible way what is happening on-chain, in the derivatives markets, and in the greater macro backdrop context for Bitcoin. This newsletter turns volatility into a joke. So hit up members.bitcoin.magazine.com and use promo code podcast for 30% off the Deep Dive. That's members.bitcoinmagazine.com, promo code podcast for 30% off. Divorce your pay group and learn why Bitcoin is the strongest asset by Dylan and LeClaire and his team.
Corey, I think you touched on a topic, which is like what Bitcoin does to you. And in the film and in Bitcoin Twitter and in along Bitcoin discourse in general, Bitcoiners are not shy about how bullish they are, how Bitcoin is going to fix a lot of aspects of society that are corrupted or flawed or anything that you could point to. Tomer, I want to dive into what's wrong with food and nourishment, what's wrong with education. What's wrong with a lot of these kind of themes, and like, what does Bitcoin have to do with food? I think that's like a good place to start.
Sure. I've been around for a little while. The food today does not taste the way the food tasted when I was. It tastes less good, less natural, less sweet. And of course, there's so much packaged food and processed food, and things that come in packages that last for a really long time that are low nutrient. I think this has a lot to do with the money, the desire to squeeze every last penny out of the productivity. And essentially the nationalization of the food supply, because we have, they're called different names in different countries, but they're different boards that supervise and have regulatory authority over different types of agriculture. The first time I became aware of this was when I got married, I went on my honeymoon to Hawaii, like so many people. And as we were driving around, there was just endless sugarcane. And I remember the taxi drivers telling us, oh yeah, the government pays people to grow sugarcane. They really want sugar here. I never thought about it again. But fast forward 25 years and everybody's got too much sugar, and it was the government that was paying everybody to produce sugar. And I live in Canada where we have these wheat boards and these milk boards, and they buy all the wheat in a nationalized way, and they invariably cause too much of it to be produced, and they end up dumping tons of it. They don't even give it to the starving countries overseas, and the same is done with milk. So they overproduce the milk by over-hormonizing and injecting the cows with all this stuff. And we just end up with all of these crops, and everything's grown to like industrial techniques, every chemical that we can put on it to get the yield up as much as possible because we sell it by the pound. And we don't get to experience the quality of food that we used to experience. And there's lots of studies that show devastating impact on the quantity of nutrient per pound of food. It's way down. It's hard to even get the proper amount of nutrients. And you look at the civilization and we're out of shape. And it's important that you exercise, but it's also important that you eat right. And it's hard to eat right when all the food is low nutrient or processed. And this is partly because everything's been mass corporatized and then regulated to the nines. And so what ends up happening is all these very large corporations that are very inhuman and focus just on next quarter's bottom line and not really about the health of the people. They themselves become part of this machine that is just manufacturing everything to the tightest specifications rather than to the specifications of quality and craftsmanship. And so we eat Wonder Bread instead of fresh baked bread. And we eat what, you know, all this really ridiculous processed stuff. And the fruits are grown to last forever over long shipping techniques rather than to be eaten fresh locally where they're grown. We've just made all these choices that are bad choices, and they're hard to get out of because big business, which succeeds at the benefit of the fiat system, because they're the only ones who can afford the lobbyists and the lawyers, they just drive the craft persons, the farmers who are local and organic, largely out of business. So again, I don't actually even claim to be the expert on this, but I'm pretty confident about much of what I've just said there. And I know, like, sometimes like by opening your eyes, I know with my tongue because I taste the food, and I know with my eyes because I look around in the population, and the leanest of us now is what we used to consider the most out of shape amongst us before. Something's gone wrong.
You're 100% with everything you just said. But there's also this sort of larger, almost mythological approach that we take in general. So like we were talking about war earlier, and if fiat incentivizes war, our psychology in that system tends to take on the characteristics of war. We approach everything through this warring mentality. And with regard to food, so much of the nutrient deficiency that we see in so many people's diets is because of the food they eat. And that food is that way because we've destroyed the soil. And why have we destroyed the soil? Because, oh, there's these pests that are invading the field. So we got to kill them. We have to drench these chemicals all over the soil so we keep this one aphid population out. And if you contrast that to the regenerative mindset, it's okay, there's this pest that's coming and it's coming in and it's destroying all of our crops. And instead of like immediately reacting and invoking the warring mentality and thinking, what do we have to kill in order to make our crop yields be more efficient? The mentality is, what do we need to shift in the total ecological landscape in order that our food production will be in harmony with those pests? So it's getting out of, hopefully, and I think we tried to paint this in the future 2048, 2100, 2109 moments in the film where it's we're doing a regenerative approach, and the whole approach there isn't trying to get rid of everything that bugs us in food production, but it's like, how can we mold our food production to be in harmony with the nature around us? Yeah, I just wanted to add that there, that it's the system that incentivizes us for the farmers to make as much crop as possible, but it's also the mentality that the farmers used to solve the problem, which is, oh, well, we got to put some chemicals on it immediately, instead of invoking the more regenerative mentality of what can we do to shift our overall relationship with the environment around us to come into harmony with it. I don't know if that made sense, but
makes total sense. And I love the even the mentality of like war on aphids or whatever. Mark, I don't know, I'm sure you have a lot to add to this conversation. We were talking a little bit about citadels and maybe this definition of citadels. I know that you're putting on a conference and you educate people a lot about how to navigate the short term of instability potentially coming up. I don't know if you have anything to add regarding maybe like how Bitcoin changes this dynamic of like chaos and volatility and gives for once, a reliable store of wealth that could potentially actually make it through that kind of a situation.
Yeah, for sure. I think about Bitcoin in obviously a bunch of ways, but it changes like one of the oldest problems that mankind has had since the beginning, which is obviously massive if you can fix that. And that's the problem of how do I store and secure my wealth, right? My value, whatever you want to call that, your property, protecting your private property. It's like the oldest problem, right? Someone's going to come take my chickens, and then people band together, and then you have villages and cities and, you know, kingdoms and countries, et cetera. And so for Bitcoin being able to allow you to store your private property in a way that doesn't require any security, any capital to do that, as well as being portable, it's hard to imagine how big of a shift that makes in the world, but it's massive when it takes away that oldest problem. A few of the ways that I think about it is that it creates certainty into the future. And so the more uncertain things are, the harder it is to plan. And you don't plan, you can't plan ahead. And so we see that today. I don't know what the laws, I heard Corey talking about California. I've been hiding out in Puerto Rico, but we're thinking about going back to California next year. But I don't know what the governor's going to have the laws be next year. Like, I don't even know next month. And so we can't live under this kind of uncertainty. And so having Bitcoin where we can store that wealth in a way that we can be certain that it can't be inflated away, seized, stolen, can't be censored, blocked, stopped, et cetera. It creates that certainty that we can now have that foundation to build our lives on. And so it gives us that base. And I think we'll just start to see amazing things being built onto that with that uncertainty gone with that base. So that's a couple of ways that I think about Bitcoin in regards to the Citadel. I've personally thought about the Citadel as a place that I would probably go with other Bitcoiners and probably have to hunker down. I know you just referenced, I've spent a lot of time thinking about maybe where the next couple of years go. Unfortunately, I think the next couple of years probably continue to get a little bit worse, more authoritarian control. They'll try to push back. The people will push back. And so I think about the Citadel in a sense where it's probably something I'm like looking at setting up. Texas has been on my radar. I'm working on a piece of property in Mexico right now. And so I've thought, it's like, where could I go to hunker down? But then I know, like Corey talked about, just where you have your Bitcoin people around with you. And I can tell you firsthand of moving from California to Puerto Rico and losing my whole community, it was super hard. I know, Christian, I think you're moving as well, or you already did and you're figuring it out, but losing your community is super hard. But anytime you can plug into a group of Bitcoiners, it's like instant community. And I think it's because we align on values, right? That's how people align. And Bitcoiners hold the highest values. And we align on those. So it doesn't matter the race, sex, religion, sexual preference, whatever you want to split people up on, but those core values that Bitcoin aligns people on. So I think of the Citadel as having that place that I can go hunker down that could be defended. I like to think of it in terms of defense. Bitcoin is the perfect defense and defend that private property, but with other Bitcoiners. And I think I'm hopeful that there's plenty of them being sprouted up, not just around the country, but around the world. I know people down in El Salvador now. I could go hunker down in that Citadel or whatever. And I think they're popping up more and more. It's encouraging. I think we're going to need them. I think people should continue to think about those. People should have a backup contingency plan. Insurance is a pain in the ass and it's expensive until you need it. And while I'm the eternal optimist and the future is better, man, a lot of things could go wrong between the next couple of years. And as far as like energy crisis, food crisis is happening, supply chains are breaking down in a really big way. And Bitcoiners are prepared. Bitcoiners are the ones that are thinking forward, thinking about the future. So anyway, I'm glad to hunker down with them anytime.
In terms of Bitcoin kind of fixing this, obviously we talked about the soil, but we also see people push back on like fitness, push back on education. Anyone on stage really passionate about rethinking those subjects? And again, why does like the money come into it?
I'll say one more thing, because this one I'm really passionate about. I'll let others tackle some of the others. But to me, I think we really missed on education as a civilization. And again, it's because we socialized education and standardized it and removed it from the free market. So we don't actually have a free market for education. Even private schools tend to be forced to teach a nationalized curriculum, or at least a state mandated curriculum. And so we don't get to experiment as we do in other things with what's the best way to raise a human? What's the best way to teach a human being? Should we let kids who are really not interested in math by grade two, just let it go? This kid doesn't want to do math. He loves drawing. He loves building things with his hand. Let him pursue what he wants rather than force him for another 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 more years to feel bad about himself because this one subject is not something that he likes. Or why not let people learn at their own pace? Why is it that every kid in the world needs to learn the same thing at the same time as the kid next to them. And our belief that this is the proper education system is completely faith-based. And it's our faith in that the government somehow knows what's right. But how do they know it? They're not running experiments to see what's better and what isn't. And they're certainly not letting us choose freely. So I think we've missed the mark so wide on education that we almost need to start to reset and just give a lot more freedom to teachers and to students and to parents to really figure out how children will grow. And we'll make mistakes along the way, but we probably won't be making as big a mistake as we are making right now, where national test scores aren't going up. We're not getting smart. There's no question that we're not getting smarter. And so I think education's a flawed system. And when the state is defunded because it can't print money left, right, and center, so too will public education. And I know that seems like a terrifying thing. Oh my God, what if we don't have public education? We have the internet education. My kids both learned to read before they entered kindergarten, before they entered the public education system, because we had a computer in the house. And they had little phonics CD-ROMs because we were a little on the older side before the internet. And it's just not that hard to get education into kids' hands without it being necessarily sitting in a classroom and writing the letter A out 30 times on this particular day of the week and then writing the letter B 30 times out on the next day of the week and learning to read at only the prescribed rate, which is too fast for some kids and too slow for others. So I think education's a mess, and it's a mess because it's nationalized and won't be under a Bitcoin standard.
Yeah, I want to share something. I completely agree with Tomer here on the government education or just some common day education. I want to bring it back to family. I think family education is very key to the success of a child. I think my father and my grandpa did a great job educating me since I was very little, before I even went to kindergarten or went to higher education. They always educated me differently than what we used to teach in school. And that deeply impacted me instead of going to university or learn about different subjects that you're really not interested in. And I'm the type of student that I don't really believe in the education system. I love to study my own stuff. I love to early on. Why can't the kids invest in this 12 years or 14 years, which I actually did that. If you're following the traditional educational system, you never really find your true passion after you graduated from university and started work 5 to 9, and then you're really lost in that society. I think that's a really important point to point out. I think family education is really important as key to a successful life.
I think a big part of it is just that fiat has made the state so much larger, and that it just has taken away a lot of the social consequences for things that we used to do as families and communities. So that is why now it's like it cuts against the family, the community, and in favor of our allegiance to our new overlords in the state and this bureaucracy. So that's what it creates. And so I think that's what a lot of Bitcoin people are keying into when they're talking about this idea of education and not government education, but just rather private education or family education, however you want to call it. It doesn't necessarily have to be a private school. It could just be even like local family co-op education, homeschooling co-op stuff. So I think there's lots of different ways to think about it. And while it might superficially seem scary, there's actually a lot of reasons why the homeschooling idea makes a lot of sense. I know a guy who's really well known in the homeschooling community back in Australia. He's like a libertarian guy talking about homeschooling from that point of view. And he makes a lot of really good points around that stuff, that sometimes it's about when that child is ready for a certain thing. And he was saying some of his children actually technically learned to read a little bit later than normal, but by then they like had way more than caught up by the time they did get there. It's less of a one size fits all approach.
The other thing I would say with that is, and while that sounds great, having that once that individual approach where kind of what you were saying, Stefan, where like different kids could be ready for different things, like unfortunately, most parents don't have the flexibility or the ability to do those types of things. The fiat money system has made it so hard to get ahead. 50 years ago, you could have one income in the family and kind of have that American dream. And today, two incomes can't really do that. And so the parents are gone. They don't really have the time to do that, which is really unfortunate. And so much is learned just at being at home with the parents, of course, if the parents are good examples. But I think Bitcoin is really doing a lot to change that. I've been encouraged to see, it's almost like anybody that comes into Bitcoin gets those orange colored lenses and see the world differently. And so I've seen a lot of people jumping into the education space, starting homeschool pods and things like that, which I think is really cool. I have two kids. They'll certainly never go back to the public education system ever again. And so we're actively looking for solutions like that. And so I think we'll see a lot more of that. One thing that I've been thinking of is that if we go back to kind of basics, like entrepreneurs, everybody really, like we earn money for providing value, right? Providing a valuable good or service to somebody else, like serving their needs. But the fiat money system has made like this system where everybody's like gambling on Dogecoin or Shibcoin or whatever. And like they're trading, options trading, the stock market exceeded stock trading. And everybody's trading, everyone's trading currencies. And none of that provides any value to anybody. And so there's this culture that's been built up where we can make money, we can increase our US dollars without ever providing any valuable good or service to the marketplace. And then we're going to make all this US dollar trading a bunch of worthless stuff without adding any value to it. And then we're going to take those dollars and then we're going to go try to buy the value and productive goods of other people. And so it's created this system where everybody's trying to cut corners, everybody's trying to cheat. And you see it in the public education system as well. They keep talking about, oh, we need to raise money. We need to raise money for the schools, but the schools have plenty of money. It's the way the system is set up where the top teachers, they never get kicked out. They take all the money, the administrators, et cetera. So yeah, this fiat system has just created this whole system. Fiat is the system of theft, lies, and deceit. And so it's just poisoned every institution, caused the entire world. All the millennials today are just trading whatever they're trading on Robinhood, not adding any value to anything. And it just permeates every area of society. And education is the most important because basically at the base of everything is your education. Were you taught the right food to eat? We talked about diet being more important than exercise. Are you eating the right foods? Do you know what your body needs? That's education. Do you know what money is? Do you know how to work? Do you know how to save? Do you know how to provide value? Do you know how to communicate? Do you know how to accomplish tasks, right? But that's all education. So it's an important topic. I'm glad that Bitcoiners are talking about it. And I'm even more glad to see Bitcoiners working on solutions for it.
Yeah, one of the things that we're not educated about is just like what money is. And I feel like Bitcoin's a forcing function for a lot of things, but I think it's a forcing function for financial literacy in general. And it might even have a similar effect to literacy that the printing press had. I think they'll have a similar effect to financial literacy. In terms of like financial, just understanding well-being, who has cosmic ideas around what this might look like? I know American HODL has given several speeches where he talks about this being the asset allocators of the future and only allocating capital in ways that actually do good and actually move things forward and a lot less speculative than things are today. I'm curious who here has thought about that.
By the way, it could be a lot more speculative as well. That's something to, it's just that the risk-reward trade-off is going to be much more carefully inspected and decided upon because our base asset is just so much better now that we actually have real money. But yeah, everything will be on a spectrum and you still may take that 1 in 10,000 chance of like a 1,000,000x payoff on some tiny startup. You'll not feel required to push way out on the risk spectrum the way that people are today, where everybody has to be a hedge fund manager basically just to stay abreast of inflation.
Corey, are you on the, yeah, are you on the treadmill, Corey? What's going on over there, man?
Man, this is a steep ass hill, and my 3-year-old is almost 4. She's getting heavier, and I'm pulling her in the wagon. But yeah, anybody on my team knows a couple times a week, they're going to get breathy, Corey. It's not pretty.
Well, something to add to what you were just saying, Corey, is also, yes, it's true around the speculativeness of it. I think a big part of it is just regulation. Right now, government is so big and there's so much regulation that you can't try little new ideas. You'll get shut down. You'll get stopped. And so every now and again, some bureaucrat regulator comes out and invents some little sandbox idea and says, yeah, look, you can go and experiment in here. And they've done that in Australia. And I think there was like an ASIC regulatory sandbox. But the reality is the current system, it just, the incentive of it, the system of it drives towards, if you've got a lot of money, you can lobby, you can influence, you've got credibility in the halls of power. And so you can influence things and keep them your way. Whereas if you're the challenger, you're the upstart, you need an ability to be able to compete without necessarily having to tick every little box that the current government wants you to. And as a part of that plays into whether it's KYC, AML, anti-money laundering laws, or whether it's other regulations that apply in education, it just applies in so many different fields. So I really think we're going to be moving into a world where
entrepreneurs will try lots of crazy ideas, and then the best ones will get replicated by everyone else, and other people in the market will then take those on and give it a go. So we are really going to have a lot better. Like, I don't want to be, what's the word, like a Pollyanna, or just say everything's going to be perfect, but we should be rationally optimist, that we should be, you know, cautiously optimistic about how things will be under a Bitcoin standard.
To put a little more flavor on that, I want to say this was everybody's favorite should-be Bitcoiner who hates us because of his ego. But I think he put something about, it was a study basically about which kinds of rich people don't mind. And basically the middle class and the lower class absolutely hates rent seekers that get to the top that are just like careerists in empty suits or whatever. But they love entrepreneurs. They love people that actually take risks but have skin in the game. Yeah, now I'm thinking about it. It's probably just the opening chapters of Skin in the Game that he sort of shows the study that somebody did. And it totally makes sense. I think that you're going to see Bitcoin, because it is so much more like equity, it is so much more like the ownership society that I started talking about 20 years ago, if you were following US politics. And I think you'll see a lot more people actually starting things and trying to make things that actually last, and not just playing this sort of like startup VC Ponzi game where everybody makes out okay, even if it's not successful, just like a lot of these altcoins, just like the natural progression of the way VC has been going for the last 20 years. I think you'll see that kind of go away. People will have skin in the game. It'll be a lot more like the engineer that builds the bridge and is required to move his family under the bridge for the first year. So he truly does have skin in the game. It'll be like that, because if you lose people's Bitcoin and you didn't give it a lot more than the college try, you ain't going to get another shot. But if you treat their Bitcoin like digital gold, and you try your hardest, and you're open and communicative, like the way that Bitcoiners are in general anyway, you'll probably get shot after shot. If you're a good entrepreneur, you'll be able to try a bunch of times.
I like the idea that Bitcoin actually lets you take more risk on, because really, if you're not a debt slave, then you can take risk. You can have some savings to rely on, so that way you can do something that's a little out there and take a risk. And there's always greater fractals to that.
Being very long Bitcoin at this stage in Bitcoin's development is incredibly entrepreneurial. Like, literally everyone who has a lot of their personal net worth in Bitcoin or is stacking irresponsibly or whatever out of their paycheck, that's an entrepreneurial decision. You're doing something that is against the grain, that is against the advice of almost everybody around you, that is unlike most of the other people around you. It's very entrepreneurial. We're raising a generation of entrepreneurs, and they're just called Bitcoiners.
Potentially future capital allocators too. So we'll see.
If you think about, you know, the fiat money system, like, it's such a horrible store of value. So it's forced everybody to find other stores of value. You didn't really see a lot of stock market activity pre-1971. Most people, it was left for the professionals. And so if you think about all the progress that's been made by these entrepreneurs that are out there trying all these things, like what Corey is saying, but they need to be able to store their value somewhere. So I could be the best cancer researcher in the world, but the money that I make, it sits in the bank and it loses value. So I can't do that. So then I'm forced to allocate that capital. I'm forced to become an investor. So now I can't just be the best cancer researcher. I have to now spend half of my time trying to figure out how to be an investor as well. And so instead of being the best cancer researcher in the world, I'm 50% of that. And think about the brain drain that's been lost over the last 50 years or 100 years even, of people that really can't even devote the time or the creativity that they need. And so Corey talks about taking that risk. If we could store our wealth in a way that can hold its value, can increase its purchasing power even better, then we can focus, we can specialize on all those things, on solving those problems, the highest value problems. And I think we get back to a massive explosion of innovation and progress like we've probably never seen. I think it's, many of us have talked about this Renaissance 2.0 scenario, where you have this explosion of information and enlightenment at the same time as you had that sound money for 300-400 years. And so we're getting into that. We get that sound money. We have the information. The internet age has kicked that into overdrive. We talked about that, like, in regards to education. And now we have globally recognized sound money. And man, things can just blow up for the better. It's going to be amazing.
I think we're almost out of time. I let RW, he's done some awesome stuff for Bitcoin Magazine, as well as his own personal newsletter around this idea of Citadel. So I'm interested in his thoughts there. And then maybe afterwards, we can each take a turn to do last words and close it out.
I love it. I love being a fly on the wall, CK. I appreciate you bringing me up. There's one idea that I've heard us dancing around as we talk about the things that are causing trouble, the things that Bitcoin fixes in a future world, just to contextualize us where we are now in history. And I really get the sense that the people who are Bitcoiners now are folks who have had their hand on the stove for a little too long. And the Citadel is not so much something that I want to build because I want to go to war with the current fiat system. It's because all I want to do when my hand is on the stove is take my hand off the stove. And I have to go somewhere that I can primarily practice asymmetric defense. That's really what it feels like to me now. Now that we've gotten popular in the last cycle, we're starting to get now more credibility, but we're making friends and a few enemies along the way. Corey, I was sad to see Talib go in full rage crit as well. But where I really think we are now with the idea of a Citadel is figuring out what asymmetric defense looks like. And what I'm really excited for is that generation that comes after, because that's where we really start to be capital allocating. That's where we start to be producing the next level of idea. And that's where I think the Bitcoin world is something that we really see and live in.
I do agree with that framework that this time it's about asymmetric defense and then maybe the future is capital allocation. But Lewis, do you want to start us off with your closing words and just thoughts for the audience?
Sure. I'm really glad this film has a very great release. Big thanks to Tomer and Matthew, of course, to help me out execute this into this beautiful creation. And I hope every family who suffer out there, it's not that there's no hope. There's this solution called Bitcoin. And I think every family who suffer from inflation, government confiscation, or regime change, they should think about store wealth in Bitcoin and move to somewhere else if that's an extreme case. So that really brings you down to Bitcoin's generational wealth, where Bitcoin's the only option, in my opinion, that you can leave it to your kids, leave it to your grandkids. And this is a beautiful idea. It's a very low time preference, long-term thinking. And I think around that idea, you can build a peaceful civilization, which the Bitcoin enable or in some sense enforced, because we couldn't use violence to take other people's wealth anymore. So in that way, you can create this kind of love and peace between each other. So that would be my closing remark. I think Bitcoin is generational wealth. And I think people outside of Bitcoin or inside Bitcoin community should really think about it. It's not, you know, just a speculative media or bubble. It's more than, and I think it really offers those hope to millions of families. And I think I will lead to Tomer and Matthew to close it up.
Yeah, I think every now and then humanity stumbles across these new technologies and discoveries, and people here have the understanding that this is something that is on par with something akin to the printing press and fire and these sorts of things with regard to how much it's going to transform the world. And we're just in this very unique spot right now where all of us are a little at the front of the transition, and we're serving as midwives in this transition to a new society, because all of those technologies, they always transform the culture in extremely profound ways with regard to print. As soon as we had letters written down on a mass scale, that ushered in the Enlightenment, right? And these major shifts happen when we have these paradigm shifting technologies. And this is a paradigm shift in monetary technology. And we don't know exactly what that's going to usher in. But to get back to the film, what we were trying to do here is, in some ways, point a shining star with something to aim at. It's like we have this new technology and there's all these new possibilities opening up, and it's transforming people in strange and interesting synchronized ways. And a culture is starting to form around it. And we're saying, hey, maybe this can be what the culture looks like. And it's not going to be the sort of dystopian future that is so prevalent in culture today. Like every Hollywood movie is like this scary future where the AIs have taken over and it's horrible. But here's a different, we're offering a different version of that. The Bitcoin culture is a different version of that. And it's more hopeful and optimistic and brings us back to nature a little bit and is a reunion of relationships with other human beings, deeper connections, and so on. So that's what we're doing with the movie.
Awesome. Thank you for that, Matt. Tomer, close it out for us. Tell people where they can find
the... It's in the nest, right up top in the leftmost thing. Bitcoin is generational wealth. Search for that on YouTube. I want to bring people back to the mood that the movie left them in with something that I wrote recently that I haven't shared publicly at all. It's short, so it's perfect for finishing words. So I call this short piece My Dream, and it's tied to this, and it doesn't mention Bitcoin or anything at all, but you know what it is. And so it goes like this. I dream of a place. In it, I dream of my family, happily smiling, enjoying nature, enjoying friends. They are occupied with doing things they love, occupied in those things, learning as they do, playing and working, the two indistinguishable, really. I as well am in this place, enjoying nature, my family, our friends, my work, my play. We have not become isolated, nor have we rejected our connection to people all over the world. We remain attached to humanity and civilization. We enjoy the music, the film, the games, and the art it shares with us. We enjoy the lessons it has to offer. We enjoy things we import into our place in exchange for the things we export. We take part voluntarily in experiments to see if new techniques of education, agriculture, construction, and well-being are more or less effective than old ones. We share the results openly and honestly with no ulterior motive to deceive others for our or anyone's benefit. Our ambitions are lofty, but they are not greedy. We wish to project the joy and love we experience onto many others, both now and into the distant future. We wish to force no one, to trick no one. We just wish to demonstrate that joy can be achieved. We do it by living an openly joyful life. Our family business is love. This is my dream. It is not a reality, not yet. I have to make it a reality. Everyone in my dream must do that too. That's the part that is in many ways out of my hands. This is because I will not force my family into my dream, a dream that I claim is one where everyone is voluntarily a part of it. But maybe, just maybe, I can show them my dream a little at a time, and they can begin to dream it too. And maybe, just maybe, they can help reshape it by telling me what they dream of to make it an even more appealing dream. I dream of that, a dream we dream together and make real together. That's what a family is. It's a dream coming true, a shared dream made of love between all, with each one making the other's joyful realization of their dreams a reality out of love. So I propose this. Let us build a dream together. Let us find a place in paradise. Let us visit it at first, our dreamland. Let us develop it. Let us see what we can make of it. Let us start dreaming, building our dreams up in this place. It is not a business. It is not an investment to make money. It is our dream.
Damn, Bitcoiners are deep, y'all. Get me every time. That was fantastic, Tomer. Thank you so much. All right. Hey, everyone, thank you guys so much for listening. Yeah, follow, subscribe to all of these folks. They're all doing fantastic work. And that's it for me. Peace.